Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm really excited to be sitting down with Amy Gomes, and we're going to be chatting today about palliative care and end of life sort of decision making and that sort of aspect of paramedicine that gets sort of missed a lot or is considered a bit more of the grey area of the job because it is such a complex sort of component to what we have to deal with. And approach with on a daily basis. So Amy is a crit care paramedic. So thank you so much for jumping on today and having a chat with me about this and sort of hopefully helping to change the conversation around this from the get-go, whether that be as a student, a grad, or if you know you're quite a few years into your career. So thanks for jumping on.
Thanks, Alex. It is a very grey area and one that I'm very passionate about. So I've got a few caveats to start with, the typical cliche. These are definitely my opinions, not based on anything that I represent from my service, but just the experience of over 10 years on road. I've done some postgrad palliative care studies and involved in a few working groups with palliative care. So it's a bit of a collective opinion, but definitely something that I'm passionate about and could talk until the cows come home about. I also need to say that there's very vastly different laws and rules across different states and jurisdictions and countries and things like that. So while this is a general discussion, please make sure that you follow whatever the service you work for or the area you're studying in, whatever they say, it does ultimately go. But essentially, my opinion derives from what I think is the right thing to do in these situations. And I hand over heart believe that you can't go wrong if you act in that manner. So if you treat patients as if they're your family member and what would be the right thing to do by them, and if that's always the patient-centered approach, then you, in my opinion, you really can't go wrong in making the right decision and a reasonable decision. So that's probably my entry to the complex world of end of life decision making and palliative care.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. Like, I mean, like you said, it's not going to be some sort of this talk or episode isn't going to be like a do this, do that. Here's a step-by-step approach. It's more of a sort of a general understanding and something to get everyone who's listening to think about sort of how you can approach these sorts of jobs that you do end up going to, and how you can best look after the patient in front of you or their family as well. So obviously dying is something that we come across a lot as paramedics and pre-hospital care. But I've found with my experience of being on road now that it's such a, I would say, taboo sort of subject. And, you know, you end up going to a lot of cases where, you know, people are obviously dying or end of life, or whether they are PAL care and they are expected to die as well. But it's not talked about amongst the patient or the family sometimes, and that can be a really challenging and uncomfortable position as a paramedic. So to start off...
definitely.
Yeah, I mean, to start off with, what from your perspective and your experience, why would that be so, do you think, and sort of... what, I guess, is the difference between end of life and this PAL care sort of part of the job?
Yeah, I think sometimes it's really easy to know whether we're resuscitating or not. You know, 50-year-old male clutched at chest, collapsed, every day of the week we'll be resuscitating those patients. The hard ones are patients who may be on a palliative care journey of sorts, but they might not be at their end of life. So we need to remember palliative care does not mean we're dying today. They're just on a journey. And that can sometimes be a very protracted journey, years for some people. So just because someone's palliative care doesn't mean we're not giving them a lot of interventions. Sometimes they need more than anything from us. It could be that the family don't know what to do. They could have, uncontrollable pain. People get a lot of horrible delirium and things like that that can make it really challenging for the family as well. So sometimes we're there and the patient could be unconscious and we're actually also there for the family, not just the patient themselves. So it, like I've said a million times already, it's just really complex. I think one thing I always say, which is very painful in every nation's public health system, is that we have all these campaigns for quit smoking and, you know, bowel cancer screening, which are extremely important. But not everyone gets lung cancer and not everyone gets bowel cancer, yet everyone dies and we don't ever talk about that. So in my ideal world, there would be a moment, not when you're 80 that we start talking about dying, but you turn 40 and all of a sudden part of your public health is that we start thinking about what are things that, you know, if you were to be on an end-of-life journey that you would you like to be at home? Would you like to be surrounded by your dogs? Would you like to, you know, be in hospital because you don't want to be afraid to be in pain? It's just something I think we really need to normalize. And then sadly, we do see a lot of situations where very young people are palliative. And that's psychologically, I can't even imagine how that component is processed by young people or by the loved ones of those patients. So yeah, there's a lot to it. And I think exactly what you said, it's taboo. We don't talk about it. When people enter nursing homes, it still blows my mind that that's not something that we discuss about what, you know, there's only sadly one way that people check out of nursing homes, but we don't even have that conversation as their entry point. Would you like CPR? You know, not just a tick or flick, but do you know what happens when someone does CPR? You know, it's not as easy as the movies show, that as we all know, that it's this life-saving intervention. You know, you need a health professional to explain when someone does CPR, you can have your ribs fractured, you could have your sternum fractured. The likelihood of someone over the age of 80 surviving an episode of CPR performed on them is not extremely high, and an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest for an elderly patient is very unlikely to be successful. So these hard conversations are just avoided because it's easier not to talk about them. Interestingly, research shows, though, that while the family might not bring up these conversations about end of life, if a healthcare provider mentions it or is happy to start and plant the seed of those discussions, family and the patients are happy to talk about it. So they're not going to put up their hand and go, can we talk about when I die? But if a paramedic even has the conversation on the way to hospital, you know, have you ever thought about what you might want to happen if your heart was to stop? That's usually a phrase that I have. And I think we're pretty good at figuring out those patients that are somewhere on their journey towards end of life. And age in itself, advanced age in itself, is a life-limiting illness, sadly. When you're 80, some point in the next 20 years, you know, amazing if you make it over the 100, but, you know, statistically, that's going to happen. It's just life. So I think one thing I'd like is if paramedics become comfortable with having very tactful conversations and read the room. There's times when it really isn't appropriate, but one thing I've found is that there are most patients who want to be able to have a say on what happens to them. If someone says to me, I want absolutely everything done, well, then that's also enters into a conversation about what does that entail? Because realistically, once you've had a solid conversation about what that entails, I've had very few patients that still come out saying, I want everything done. And I think it's also important to talk about things like organ transplant and donation and stuff, and not for paramedics to have discussions on. So I do want to add that component in. That's to be only reserved for people who are qualified in having those difficult conversations. So please don't talk about organ donation with patients. That's just an area that we're restricted from talking about. But things like, you know, artificial feeding or ventilation or something like that, antibiotics, They're things that people just don't even think about. So it is important for us to just try and tap into it or talk to the family. Have you ever thought about what might happen? Because as we know, the hardest time to have those conversations is in the heat of the moment. So if we can prime a family or a patient to even just start thinking about it, even just one little question about it tactfully, that might give them a moment to prepare themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are fantastic points. And something that you said there was really interesting, and it's kind of like what you're saying, clarifying sort of what people mean as well. So, you know, I've come across patients that they say, and I've asked, do they have a DNA CPR, which is one of the paperwork here in the UK. It's part of our questioning, because if they do have it, we always have to take it with them. But when I've asked that before, they said, no, I want everything done. And when you ask them what that means, that just they're just wanting, like, might be different for different patients, but the common answer has been, no, like, if I get an infection, I want to be treated, or if I get this and that, I still want to be treated at hospital. But they didn't understand it's for, like, actual resuscitation, CPR, things like that. And then when they've understood what that entails, I've noticed a bit of a change in some of the people I've spoken to about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I remember once I had a loved one in hospital who was not well, and I remember I said to them, I want someone to come and talk to, it was my grandfather, I said, I want someone to talk to my grandfather and my grandmother about an acute resus plan, or whatever the terminology might be, you know, advanced health directive. There's lots of different types. And it was interesting. A lot of the time they put it off because they realised I was a paramedic, and they thought, why can't you sort of talk about that? Which I was pretty disappointed about, because as the family member, even though I'm very invested in this, I felt like that was a time I could step back and allow a external person to have that conversation. It's a bit nicer hearing it from someone else, I guess. But this doctor who ended up coming and having a chat was actually extremely remarkable, and went through the side effects and contraindications of CPR. I'd never heard the way that they'd presented it before. And essentially, I guess as paramedics, we're so used to thinking about saving people, and a lot of what we do is how we can save people and what we can do to prevent them from dying. But this doctor talked about, you know, despite being dead, if you're having CPR performed on you, the side effects of CPR are extensive, and there are contraindications. Advanced age, you know, we should not be doing that. It is so traumatic for an elderly patient. If that's what they want, it makes it complicated. If that's what the family want, yes. But we really are doing something that is unlikely to have a positive outcome. That's really, is that really ethically right, that we're causing more damage? And like I said earlier, the side effects of CPR are, you know, we all know that there's occasions where we fracture ribs, and not intentionally, but that does happen. And a patient who's got a fractured sternum and lots of fractured ribs with advanced age is not going to come off a ventilator. They're just not going to survive. I'm not sure if that's really what we should be doing. It is difficult. And like I said, when I've talked to those patients that say, I want everything, you need to find out, what are they afraid of? Is it because they don't want to be in pain? We are not God. We can't save everyone. And it gets to a point where we're legally, under the banner of good medical practice, I know in Australia, you don't have to keep intervening. So there's, I wouldn't know what the UK laws are, but essentially in an emergency situation, you legally do not have to offer them every single possible intervention. Firstly, we won't be able to be aware of everything that's possibly available. But in an emergency situation, we don't have to list off everything that we could possibly provide. And I think I always read the room. So if you feel like, especially in a nursing home, I find those I guess on the scale, a little bit easier to navigate because people accept that, you know, there might be a time when their family members pass. But one example, so like elderly lady at home, son's come around to visit her, found her collapsed, but she wasn't at that stage deceased, but she was agonally breathing on my arrival. And I very quickly ascertained she's late 90s. This is her terminal event. And I was by myself and I thought I can either start CPR and we can be very aggressive with our management of this frail, very cachexic 98-year-old who's having her final moment on earth while her son watches me brutally do this, or we can put a pillow behind her head and her son can sit with her. And it was remarkable. I said to him, should we make her comfortable? And that's what he was happy with. And that's probably one of the best things we can do. Give the family that option that we don't have to do all this. It's okay. Let's be there. Yeah, it was remarkable to see the change when he realized that this is what's happening, but it's okay. And I think, yeah, it would be nice if we gave all of our patients that peaceful final moment, I guess, because usually the family end up out of the room while we're doing so many things and they don't get that final moment. So this gentleman sat with his mom while she literally took her last breaths. As I said, she was agonally breathing, and I just put pads on to see what rhythm she was in. And she was in a PEA at that stage, a very, very slow, broad, complex PEA. And we just supported her. And afterwards, he was so grateful for that. And I thought to myself, if that was my loved one, that's exactly what I would want. I would want those moments. He sat there and he talked to her and he held her hand and we kept her comfortable and warm. And that's how we should let people pass. Alternatively, there was a crew coming. We could have made a resus attempt on her. But is that good medical practice? And I think that probably leads into my next part. You know, when I am treating patients, you know, palliative care patients aside, where we have a bit of a plan, when I'm treating a patient, I always think, what is their clinical trajectory? So this helps me make my decisions, or helps me provide advice to the family who are making decisions, regarding the care of a loved one who doesn't have capacity. So let's say this exact patient, this 98-year-old patient who's in cardiac arrest, it looks very frail. She looked like she weighed about 45 kilos. There was no CPR when I arrived. You know, there's lots of things. She's got lots of comorbidities. As I said, she's advanced age. I know every day of the week that patient's not going to return home in the same state as she was before this event occurred, if she returns home at all. If she returns home at all. So most of these patients don't, if we even get her to hospital. So I think to myself, what are we doing here? What are we intervening for? Do we think this patient is going to walk out of hospital? If the answer is, I don't even know if we're going to get ROSC at all, we're just trying to make ourselves feel better by doing CPR, then that's not the right thing to do. So I always think, what is our clinical trajectory? Is this patient going to likely survive? If the answer is 100% not a chance in hell, then what are we doing? So I think if there's any chance of a positive outcome, obviously resus. I don't want someone to be like, oh, but I'm not sure if we were going to have a positive outcome, so we just didn't start. That is not at all what I'm trying to say. These are those complex cases where you've just got to put a little bit more thought into it. And that probably comes with experience. Like 20-year-old Amy, brand new qualified, probably wasn't comfortable making some of these decisions. So phone a friend, ask a colleague, make a team decision, or just stick to what you're comfortable with. If you resus someone and then later on find out they had a not for resus of some sort, it's okay. You're doing what you think is best at the time. And I always say to some people, you know, the classic one comes up, and I know you just said that you need to view paperwork there, but people say, oh, but they didn't have the original document. And I say to them, what did you think would happen? You know, the family are begging you not to resus, but they can't find the documentation. They're clearly the next of kin. Like, what are you afraid is going to happen? Oh, I don't know. Someone might sue me because I didn't do a resus because I didn't cite it. Sorry. So my point is, what is going to happen if you don't resuscitate that patient? The family sure as hell aren't suing you. They're the ones begging you not to. So I think there's this fear that people will get into trouble for not resuscitating a patient if they haven't viewed the documentation. If the family on scene are telling you not to and they're the next of kin, they're the substitute decision makers. The patient is unconscious, so they are the people that will be giving the hospital advice or authority to do something. So it is okay to follow what they want us to do. And if someone was to, you know, be hauled over the coals for that, I don't know, I'd sleep well at night knowing I did the right thing by that family. That's pretty much where I fall on those ones where you don't have the legal paperwork. They are the decision makers for that person now. So I guess there's, like I said, there's no black or white do this or that, but it really is about feeling the room and thinking about what's likely to happen for that patient, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. And I think you're right, like it's such a grey area and we're so used to black and white in pre-hospital care, like do this, do that, follow this algorithm. And, you know, it is a really challenging aspect. And something that someone brought up the other day who I was working with said, you know, there is a difference between just dying and a cardiac arrest. Like, is that 98-year-old you went to in cardiac arrest, like having a cardiac arrest, or are they just dying? Like, they're at that point in their life where they're just dying. And I think that's something that's quite an interesting sort of perspective changer, at least that I found.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we need to change, like I was saying earlier, change our mentality about paramedics are here to save everyone. And it is hard to find those situations where we accept we're not there to save them now. We're there to be there for the family, and we're there to make sure that people have a final journey that, you know, is what we would wish of our loved ones. I think it is really brave to be like, no, we're not actually doing this. Let's do what the family want, especially in areas where the services may not necessarily support that. I've got lots of people who've reached out to me before and have said, no, you know, this is internationally as well. No, our service, we can't even declare someone, you know, deceased. So we must resuscitate everyone. That's really unfortunate, and it's hard because that's not what the right thing is. And as paramedics, we have a really good position to be making some of these decisions and supporting the family to make those decisions. Like I said, it's not something I would expect a grad to walk in and be able to feel comfortable having those conversations. But it's definitely an area that we are, whether people like it or not, we are in the thick of it. So I've made a conscious effort as a CCP now to not be the one who's delivering the bad news to the family all the time. If there's a crew on scene that are comfortable, I wouldn't just throw them in, but I say to them, did you want to talk to the family about the possibility that we might be stopping soon, or update them that we haven't had a positive change or anything like that? I always prime the family with an update throughout, so that when we get to the final decision, they at least have had a moment to prepare for that, rather than, you know, we're off working for 20 minutes and then you come in and go, I'm sorry, your loved one's passed away. And that would be on, you know, cases not related to palliative care and stuff. So the ones that were a clear cut, we're resuscitating. But I say to my colleagues now, would you like to have, like, try and have that conversation? Because none of us learn or get experienced in these difficult communication situations if we never actually get an opportunity. Or I say, would you like to come with me while I talk to the family? Because that's something that I've unfortunately had to experience a lot. And when I worked more rural and remote, you had no choice but to be the person who was delivering that bad news. But I think it's something that we all have to do at some point. And if it's a safe opportunity to learn, then I give them that chance.
Yeah, for sure. And that's something that I think I'm going to clump these two episodes together. There's one with obviously yourself now, but there's also one with someone named Alex Jabba, and we spoke about sort of end of life or like death communication, and you know, and it was a really fascinating conversation about, you know, we're so primed to be doing things that sometimes, like, you know, having these these conversations are also part of that gray area and something that we don't necessarily feel prepared to do. So it's a really fascinating thing that you're talking about as well, because even like I remember having to do it for the first time, but this person had paperwork, you know, that said not for hospital admission for any situation, and for PAL care, wasn't even for, you know, 999 calls, but we were there, you know, made them comfortable and then had to call that family and be like, you know, this is a situation, you know, what do you want to do? And that question came up of, will she feel any pain or will he feel any pain, or, you know, like things like that. And and then actually calling GPs and putting in place those what we have over here, like pink card medications or anticipatory medications, and then having those put out. And it was a really interesting case, because you actually got to, whilst it was sad for the family, empower them to help them make their decisions, and then also put in place medications and make that person comfortable and give them a good death. But talk about dying, like, you know, whilst they may not die today, they're on their way there.
Yeah. And you just said something that's like really important. And I think a phrase that I've heard a lot in the palliative care arena is that good death. And when we start accepting that people are dying, we can start thinking about how we actually put plans in place. If people are in denial forever about the fact that they're going to die, and this is, as I said before, this is aside from young people, that is never something we expect. But there's still so many times where I've been to patients that to me were fairly obviously at their end of life journey or their terminal event. And I've started trying to test the waters with the family where they are at with understanding that. And some of them are completely blindsided. And that is frustrating for me, because I feel like, you know, at some point another, you know, medical professional should have had this conversation, but sometimes that's where we're at. It's if we do better at preparing people, then we can plan better to make that end of life journey a good death, like you said. No one wants it to happen, but there actually are some unbelievably movingly beautiful end of life situations I've been involved in, which still thinking of give me goosebumps. And I just think it's absolutely honourable what some family and loved ones have done for their loved one in the final moments. And I always make that a point to say to people, if I've been to an end-of-life case where maybe we're just there because they're not sure if they've passed or something and they weren't really sure what to do, or, you know, they didn't quite understand what the next step was, or they can't tell if they can feel a pulse or something. Those ones where you get there and we're really just doing a recognition of death type situation. I make a point of telling the family that, you know, it really is wonderful what they've done, because it's not easy. And sometimes they probably question whether they're doing the right thing. And there's, like I talked about earlier, a lot of end of life patients do get a degree of delirium. And it can be really traumatic for loved ones to see that. They can hallucinate and go through some really difficult stages as they're dying. So, yeah, it's hard, and it's the easy thing would be to, you know, ignore it, but trying to model some sort of a situation that the patient wants can be really challenging for the bystanders. And I think that's also important to note. If we get called because that plan is not going well, we need to also support the family to know they haven't failed the patient. There's so many times where people go, they wanted to stay at home, but I just can't do this anymore. That is such a hard situation for that person. And dying isn't always, you know, this super peaceful, close my eyes and go to sleep. It can be horrible. And we just need to make sure we are supporting those loved ones that are trying to do the best by the patient, because it can be really, really terrible. And I think that's just an important thing to remember. I also probably want to just add in which potentially your other person you interviewed may have talked about, but making people presentable after they've passed is also something really important. And I won't speak a lot on that because it may have already been touched on, but just little things like putting people's dentures back in, or, you know, making sure that their hair's combed or they are in bed peacefully. This is not patients that we're, you know, suspicious any odd activities happened or anything like that. These are the patients that we're comfortable a death certificate will be signed or something like that. But putting them back in bed, not leaving them on the floor, tucking them in, making sure they look presentable, putting the air cons on. I know you're in the UK, so that's probably not relevant for you, but please make sure that you keep patients cool, because it does definitely slow down some of the, you know, things that occur after death, and putting their head up slightly so that they don't get any passive regurgitation or anything like that. Because if we're allowing families to sit with patients after they pass, we need to just make sure that they're not going to have fluid come out of their mouth or anything traumatic for their loved ones. So that's my 2 cents worth. Can we just make sure we're doing the right thing by not just walking away once all the hard stuff's done, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point that I think I'll be taking forward as well. But in sense of, I guess, the palliative care side of things, like you said, you know, we'll get called potentially for when the plan isn't going right, or, you know, the family are really struggling. Would part of that sort of understanding, because obviously here in the UK there are for different services, different trusts, different areas, there's all different access to support for specific, you know, palliative care side of things, and probably the same in Australia. I've quite literally forgotten because I haven't been there for a while now. So, you know, but like having an understanding about what support's available, and sort of educating yourself on end of life sort of signs, symptoms, things like that, and then also same with PAL care and what you can do for them.
Mm. Yeah, it's a similar challenge here, especially out of hours. It can make it more difficult to find some appropriate interventions. I always ask the patients, what involvement do they have from palliative care? So I think usually I'll try and gauge whether or not they've had a lot of involvement. Is there a palliative care team we can call directly? Usually we have time on these jobs, so these will be the jobs you put that extra effort into, making sure we've exhausted all other avenues before we just go to hospital, unless that's what they want. Like I said, it's patient-centered care, as all our care is, but these are the times where you just really need to nut down what is it that you want. And it might be that they're going to hospital purely for a review of their medication. So just because you're taking them to hospital does not mean they need to be admitted. And I always make a point of communicating that if they go, I don't want to be in hospital, I don't want to die in hospital. But there might not be anything more we can do for them pre-hospitally, and they're struggling with pain, or their family's struggling with some of the other side effects of end of life. And so I always say, and this isn't just me trying to convince them to go, this is true, they have the right to leave whenever they want to. So when I get to hospital, I communicate that to the doctors and the nurses caring for them. This patient's here for a medication review. They do not want to be admitted. This is not where they want their end-of-life journey to end. So if they can be reviewed for medication and then they want to be returned home. So be an advocate for your patients in that sense. But they need to know that going to hospital isn't just a linear destination. Like, it doesn't mean that they will be there against their will, I guess. People have rights. If they don't want to go, we can't force people to go. Obviously, capacity involved and stuff like that. But yeah, it's worth spending that time digging into it a bit more, rather than them just saying, I don't want to go to hospital, and you going, okay, you know, what part of it, you know, we can't always do everything pre-hospitally. But yeah, it's a challenge to find out what teams are involved. It can be really challenging, especially palliative care kids. That's a really difficult area. And I think one thing I've learned, that even if the family know that their child has been deemed palliative or their illness is terminal, there is nothing that prepares the parents for that final moment. So I think to them there's always hope, even though they understand. So you might be surprised by their, I guess that sometimes they're still in denial, and I don't blame them. Having kids now myself, gosh, you'd try anything. So pediatric palliative care is a whole different kettle of fish, and I think they're the most amazing people who work in pediatric palliative care. It must be just such a difficult area. But kids with palliative conditions will usually have a fairly structured team, and I would call them, you know, nearly immediately from when I got on scene. There's no point you trying to navigate that and give the parents, you know, the options or anything, when the palliative care team might go, oh, we actually can come out there. I've had that multiple times. So don't try and navigate some of these jobs by yourself. Phone a friend. Even if it's not part of your services policy to call or consult someone else, I would always call a patient specialist, or at least their offices, or to see if there's anything that we can do. Like I said, don't just rush them up to hospital. Let's try and figure out what we can do pre-hospitally, or can we get someone to come to them? You know, can we get a GP to prescribe a script for some breakthrough pain or something? You've got to think outside of the box for these jobs, because their time on earth is limited, and I'm sure no one wants to be away from their family in an ambulance when they could be spending that valued time at home, I guess.
I guess from now, like, I mean, we've gone through sort of what palcare is, what end of life is, sort of those discussions, and sort of trying to make some of those really challenging decisions. What would be sort of, from your point of view, what we sort of missed and what you really think is important to relay back to everyone?
I think if you always approach the jobs, like I said in the beginning, as if it's your loved one and what you think would be right by them, regardless of what service you work for and what jurisdiction and law you fall under, I don't think you can really make the wrong decision. If you are, you know, making these decisions well-intended and with communication with the family and doing what you think the patient wants and what the family wants, then you really can't go wrong. Additionally, if there's those cases where you think not resuscing is the right thing to do and the family just haven't come to that realization yet, communicate. They're hard, and give them time to understand that their loved one's passing. Don't just assume that because they're palliative that everyone's on board that this is what's happening. I don't think most people really ever are ready to lose their loved ones. And if it's on the pediatric topic, if it's kiddies, try and get the parents involved in some way. Let them hold the kid's leg, you know, be there with their child, especially if it really is that terminal event. Don't send them off to go and do something. They need to be there with their child during those final moments. And I think what's hard in those situations is that They, like I said, they don't want to lose that hope, and we are the ones there giving them that final notification. So just be really, really prepared for some difficult conversations and difficult reactions. But please try and encourage them to be with their child during those final moments, even if it's hard for them. It's important for them to spend those final moments with their child. But I think one thing that might help some of the end-of-life decision-making for the listeners, there's actually a really good free course done by QUT called End-of-Life Law for Clinicians. And I did some stuff on the paramedic section for that, and it really is a valuable resource. Obviously Australia-based, but it still gives you a good idea of some of the complex decisions that healthcare workers are involved in, but also it goes into hierarchy of decisions and who would we be looking for information from if the patient loses capacity and there's no formal documentation and things like that. It's just a really good resource to sort of test your brain about some hypothetical situations as well. So that would be somewhere where I'd suggest people go for some further knowledge.
Awesome. I'll pop that link into the show notes so everyone can check that out as soon as they can as well. So that's great. Is there anything you want to say before we wrap up, or are you happy?
I think I'm pretty happy.
Awesome.
I'm always welcome for discussions or hypothetical situations thrown at me. So if anyone wants to reach out, I'm very passionate for this area, because I think we can definitely do better by our patients than just always trying to save everyone's life. We need to be the ones that also tell them that this is the end, and yeah, and take off that lifesaver sort of mentality, I guess. So always happy to be approached for discussions.
Awesome. And where can people find you to do that?
I'm on Twitter.
Well, definitely pop your Twitter handle on there, and then people can come to you for that as well. And sure. I really appreciate you coming on and having this chat, because I think it's really important. And I think starting this sort of educational, like, understanding early on in your career is going to be incredibly beneficial.
Yeah, me too. I think we can all learn something from these cases. So I never stop learning every time I go to these. I know that's very cliched, but no one's death is the same, and it's very thought-provoking.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for jumping on.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.